Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. How should we think about the risk of aspartame, our vaccine ingredients? Does a reasoned look at the facts support a conspiracy by pharmaceutical companies to control medical care? How does understanding the placebo effect help us understand whether echinacea prevents colds? Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Our outside Anchorage, you can call 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at APRN.org. Coming up next hour, we'll talk with Brian Dunning on Line One, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by The Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're discussing critical thinking as it's applied to current healthcare topics. And my guest is Brian Dunning, author and producer of Skeptoid.com. Our phone numbers are should be familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska in Anchorage. It's 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us at lineone@APRN.org. Before we get started, I just want to take a moment to remind listeners that next week's guest is Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He's of the University of Washington School of Public Health, and we'll be exploring ways our population's health seems to be better than it is outside of recessions. That is, it's better during recessions, and why it seems to be our population health, that is, seems to be declining versus other rich countries, even though we spend close to twice as much per person for health care. Brian, welcome to Line One.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Brian's podcast, Skeptoid, has a weekly audience of about 66,000 listeners, and he is the author of two books based on the podcast, Skeptoid and Skeptoid 2. He's a Silicon Valley computer scientist by trade and uses this new media to promote critical thinking. He's appeared on numerous radio and television shows. It's really a pleasure to have you here, and as we were talking before we came on the air, I think maybe a reasonable place to start is just to talk about what skepticism is, how that relates to maybe science and critical thinking. Would you mind doing that for us?
Absolutely. Skepticism is basically the process of applying critical thinking to follow the scientific method to learn the truth about a subject. In pop culture, we're constantly exposed to all sorts of weird claims about this or that, whether it's on television, on Oprah, and even a lot of news publications. A lot of the reporting is not terribly scientifically accurate, but the average person on the street has no way of knowing that. So we use skepticism, which is to basically question what you're being told and then use research and the scientific method to understand what's really going on. And the rewards of that are huge. It's always more fascinating, brings rich rewards to learn what's actually going on than to learn the popular paranormal supernatural explanation.
Give me an example of that. I happen to agree with you 100% that when you really get into the science, it's just fascinating sometimes. Give us an example of what you think of when you say that.
Well, one of the most interesting ones that I did not too long ago, we were talking about ghosts and how people can see apparitions. Well, there are actually real ways that your eyes can have hallucinations induced into them. It's not necessarily a ghost. If you stop at the paranormal explanation, you're robbing yourself of a really fascinating phenomenon where infrasound, low-frequency sound that's below the range of what you can hear, can actually oscillate the fluid inside your eyeballs in very specific circumstances, obviously, and create visual hallucinations. And it's been shown that that's been the cause of at least some ghost sightings. That is really cool, and that's fascinating, and it's real science.
To me, when I hear that kind of thing, it makes me jump immediately to I'm trying to remember the name of the book by Carl Sagan. Oh, The Demon-Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark. And what he was kind of basically saying is everything seems kind of superstitious, weird, has unusual explanations, often supernatural, until you really hold a candle to it, which science allows us to do. And then it becomes even more fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fantastic book. It's one that should be on everyone's shelf, Carl Sagan's Demon-Haunted World. I did another podcast this week, in fact, that was about the Baigong pipes. You mentioned that. And it's a series of apparently metal pipes embedded in ancient rock in China 150,000 years ago. Well, how could that happen? The default explanation is, it must have been an alien construction project. Well, what's fascinating is when you study it, when you read the scientists who actually did the real research to find out what was going on, these are casts of bamboo trees from that long ago that are fossilized, and they end up looking like metallic pipes buried in ancient rock. Mm. That's cool.
Yep. Yeah, that was I happened to listen to that this morning coming to work, and it. It was interesting to hear where that was going as you were about to sign off on the podcast in the middle to make everybody think, oh, yeah, okay, so it was 150,000 years ago it was a Martian that did that.
Yeah, I did. I kind of tried to trick the audience a little bit in the middle. They're used to hearing me sign off at the end of the show when I've explained the actual explanation. I did it halfway through when I'd only mentioned the popular paranormal explanation. And people were going, what? He's not going to tell us what actually happened? Again, I was just trying to drive the point home of don't stop halfway at the popular paranormal explanation. Go all the way and find out what's really happening, and that's where you find the real treasure.
Well, let's take a medical topic that's had a lot of popular explanations. Let's go to vaccine problems and some of what seems to be popular on TV and what's real. What's your comments on vaccine concerns, particularly?
You know, what you're hearing mostly these days is a lot of parents concerned from what they're hearing from celebrity activists about these horrible poisons that are in vaccines. Well, you can go to the CDC website, the Centers for Disease Control, and they publish the list of what all the vaccines are and what all the ingredients are. And it's a little bit scary because you do see some of these horrible-sounding poisons that the celebrity activists are talking about, i.e. formaldehyde, mercury, antifreeze, latex rubber. Some of these are true, some of them are not true, and the ones that are true are there for a very good reason, and it's been completely misunderstood and misrepresented why these ingredients are in there.
Mm-hmm. I know one of them is that we hear about a lot is mercury, and then I recently saw some comments where Paul Offit, who's one of the real deep researchers on immunizations, has commented that his finding is that there's more mercury in breast milk. A child who's breastfed is going to have far, far more mercury ingestion than would be in the vaccines. And the point is when you hear about that there's mercury, that makes you worry. But the real story is it's hard to avoid mercury.
Yeah, and what they also fail to mention is that mercury, it's like, you know, sodium and table salt. It's not just plain elemental mercury.
Right.
It's bound with other elements, and that makes it a completely different material with totally different characteristics. Ethyl mercury is what is found in thimerosal, the preservative used in vaccines, some vaccines. And ethyl mercury is very quickly and easily discharged from your body by your kidneys. It's not a problem. Methylmercury is the version that's actually quite dangerous because it's not easily discharged from your body and it can hang around and cause neurological damage. So the type of mercury that some vaccines do contain is not even a dangerous type.
Let me take a second to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. We're talking with Brian Dunning today, and we're talking about how to apply critical thinking to some of the healthcare concerns that are being exposed or discussed throughout the media. If you have questions today, our number is 550-8422. 550-8422 is our local number. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And you can also reach us at line1@aprn.org if you want to email. Another thought that comes to my mind with that is that you have talked about, and anybody who gets involved in skepticism thinks about and reads about logical fallacies. And another thing that seems that the vaccine warriors or naysayers do is they have begun to move the goalposts, which is a logical fallacy. And we hear more and more, less and less about mercury as the evidence is coming out that MMR and mercury is really not having any big problems. And the most recent one seems to be this product called squalene, which is a natural product, again, that's pretty prevalent, but has made some headlines recently.
Yeah, and not only that, but aluminum, aspartame, it goes on and on. One of the more interesting ones is when they say antifreeze. Mm. You know, antifreeze is it's propylene glycol or it's ethylene glycol. And the reason that people look at that is it's the same type of hydrocarbon as what's actually found in some of these vaccines, which is something called 2-phenoxyethanol. Forgive me if I mispronounce that. I'm terrible with gigantic chemical names. So it's the same chemical family, but it's very different. And that's often the case with a lot of these terrible-sounding poisons that they try to use, you know, the shock value of to scare people out of getting vaccinated.
Another issue I'd love for you to talk about, because I thought you did it so well. You had a podcast on the placebo effect, and I mentioned that in the introduction and how it may help us understand why some products are said to be effective, but then we find by looking at the placebo effect that that may not be true. If you wouldn't mind just giving us as much as you want to talk about, because you did such a great job.
The placebo effect is so fascinating. It's something that's not well understood. I mean, we know a fair amount about how and why it works, but we don't know everything about how and why it works. Certainly, belief is apparently a fairly large factor in its effectiveness. Basically, the placebo effect, quickly defined, is when you think something is going to work, it will work. It may actually provide you some relief, just based on tricking your brain into thinking that it's getting some relief. Now, it's important to understand that it's not going to have any actual clinical effect if you have a disease agent, if you actually have some illness that's caused by a real disease agent. A placebo has no ability to improve that condition. But for symptoms, particularly self-reported symptoms like pain, fatigue, headaches, nausea, things like this, it can provide genuine relief for those symptoms of a real condition. Or if you have a condition for which there is no disease agent at work, for example, nausea during a pregnancy, a placebo can actually address and in some cases can solve the problem, but it can actually help. So this presents an interesting dilemma for researchers who are trying to test drugs. How do we know if the drug that we're testing that's having a good effect, how do we know if it's actually doing anything or if it's just having a placebo effect? And the purpose of a clinical trial when we're testing a new drug is we want to find out if it has any effect beyond the placebo effect. So we have to test with a control group who's receiving the placebo. And that's where you open up a whole other realm of really interesting information, because it's the characteristics of the placebo that can also have a huge effect on its effectiveness. Can you say that, an effect on its effectiveness?
You did, and I followed that.
For example, dramatic interventions like a shot, that's really dramatic. I mean, right. Physically sticking a needle into your skin, that's going to have a larger effect than a pill because it seems more dramatic. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for something that's a stimulant, a red pill is a more effective placebo than a blue pill. If you're looking for something to relax you, a blue pill is more effective than a red pill. Branded placebos are more effective than generic placebos. It goes on and on. I mean, they've been able to establish all sorts of ways that placebos can be more or less effective in given situations.
And so to show that a treatment of any sort is really effective, they should be better than the placebo, which is another way of saying it's better than doing nothing at all.
Well, you can have, generally you'd have in a well-designed clinical trial of some sort of medical treatment, you'd want to have at least three groups. You'd want to have a group receiving no treatment.
Right.
You'd want to have a group receiving a placebo treatment. Mm. And you'd want to have a group receiving the treatment that's being tested.
Right.
And you want to make, what you're going to find out in almost all cases is that the placebo group will improve more than the group that received no treatment at all.
Right. Right.
And ideally, the treatment you're testing will improve better than the placebo group.
And depending on your endpoint, what kind of test you're looking at, some of these placebo effects can be 20% of people, you know, one out of five, even higher, particularly with like headaches or things that where you're saying, well, how do you feel after you do something? It's amazing how in some situations it can be so effective.
Yeah, by my research, any given placebo is effective on about a third of patients, but almost everyone will respond to some type of placebo. And a placebo doesn't have to be a pill. It can be, you know, a shot of saline solution. It can be applying heat. It can be a massage of nothing in particular. It can be basically anything you can do to a body can be given as a placebo.
Mm-hmm. We talked before we came on the air about the kind of the converse of that is something called a nocebo effect. That is something that really shouldn't do any harm, but when you take it, it makes you feel ill or causes problems, which is another psychological kind of response to the idea of treatment.
Exactly. In fact, that's another way of making the placebo effect more of a dramatic intervention. If you give the placebo to someone and you say, well, wait a minute, this has side effects, this may make you nauseous, it may give you headaches, it may keep you up at night, you give all sorts of stern warnings about how powerful this placebo is, it's going to be more effective in most cases. And as you point out, you're giving a placebo that's really does nothing, but it's going to give this person negative side effects. And that's when we use the Latin for nocebo, which means I do harm. Placebo means, what does it mean? I please you. And right. Nocebo right. means I harm you, basically.
Right. The other comment I made in my introduction was about Big Pharma as a conspiracy. And I don't know that I hear that a lot in my practice, but it certainly is an argument against a lot of health care, medical care. And I've heard you on your podcast discuss that. Can I ask you to do that today for us?
Yeah, the Big Pharma conspiracy is, I had a volleyball shoulder surgery not long ago, and I was discussing this with my doctor this morning. We got into a big discussion about the Big Pharma conspiracy because he'd recently been using a new screw for orthopedic injuries that had all kinds of problems and had to be pulled off the market, and it turned out that the pharmaceutical company had made some unethical shortcuts in bringing this product to market, and the trials weren't really valid. So that was a case where the system failed. The system's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. The system does have weaknesses, and it does fail from time to time. And so a lot of people will look at that and they say, gee, the pharmaceutical process is flawed, it's not trustworthy, and therefore complementary and alternative medicine is valid. Well, of course, one doesn't say anything about the other, but a lot of people tend to think that it does. That's another logical fallacy right there. Mm-hmm. If person A is in jail, what does that tell us about person B? Well, nothing at all. But pointing out the flaws in the pharmaceutical industry doesn't constitute support for alternative medicine by any stretch of the imagination or any stretch of logic. So people tend to think that there's this Big Pharma conspiracy. In some cases, they take it to the point where they think all the pharmaceutical companies are conspiring with government to keep us all sick because that way they can make more money by giving out more and more of these quack medical treatments that don't actually do anything. And this is a pretty harmful belief because in a lot of cases, it actually does scare people away from getting needed medical treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another big issue. Is a lot of times, you know, you hear people say, "Well, what's the harm of trying something?" And I've often tried to ask or talk to my patients about things. You always want to know and ask what's the risk and benefit. But so many patients want to assume that there is no risk, and there is risk of doing things, and there's risk of not doing it. And I think this website that I've decided to put a link on today's program on our website is this whattstheharm.com. Are you familiar with that website?
Yes, it's whattstheharm.net. Run by a gentleman named Tim Farley who has put years of research and he continues to work on it every day. Essentially what it is he scours the news looking for cases where someone with a pseudoscientific belief or some magical belief suffered direct harm as a result of it. And the purpose of his website is to answer the question that people are always asking. You know, I believe in reflexology or whatever it is. What's the harm in that? It's a harmless belief. What's the harm if I like it and it works for me? Well, Tim has decided to answer that question. What's the harm? You look up reflexology on his website, and you'll find cases where it's resulted in injury, death, loss of money, whatever it is. And he covers not just medical topics, but all sorts of things. You know, people do multi-level marketing, and they suffer huge losses as a result of it, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's a great resource, and I recommend it for anyone.
Why did you get into this business? I know we talked before that you had an interest in film production, and mm-hmm. but, you know, where were you when you said, well, gosh, why don't I do a podcast on skepticism? Why skepticism, if you wanted to, you know, scratch your itch for production and media?
Yeah, you know, I have to say that it was just due to some pet peeves that I had. I had a number of – when I first started the podcast, I was not intending to have this turn into my full-time career by any stretch. I figured I'd do 5 or 10 episodes and get it out of my system and be done with it. So I decided to pick a few of my pet peeves. And one of them, I think the very first episode, was called New Age Energy. It was how virtually everyone who's selling anything that does nothing, they use the word energy, your body's mystical energy fields. The magical energy of this or the magical energy of that. People misuse the word energy to serve whatever purpose they want, and it's almost always to sell some product or service that's worthless. So in that first episode, I basically explained what the word energy means. It's a measurement of something's ability to do work. It's not some hovering, glowing cloud that adepts can draw power from and employ to create miracles. It was just something that had always just kind of stuck in my craw. Every time I heard someone use the word energy in a meaningless sense, it got me a little ticked off. And so that was how I got started. And it just kind of went from there. People started sending me ideas almost right away. And having a lifelong passion for science, I just really became caught up in this process of researching questions, all these strange things I'd never heard of before, all these strange things people were writing in and asking about. And it's fascinating to uncover what's actually going on in some of these weird cases.
How do you – let me just ask you to ferret out how you go about researching a particular issue. And if you could use one that's medically oriented, it would be nice but not necessary. I just kind of want to – I guess what I'm trying to do is highlight the difference between a very superficial explanation, which is supernatural or, you know, something that's not very well thought out and doesn't fit the facts, which is so often the issue, and then what happens when you really dig into it and start asking the right questions and research and spend a little effort, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I should stress that I'm not a medical doctor. Right. I'm basically a science researcher. My job is to research stuff, find out what's actually going on, and then put it in terms that's A, entertaining, and B, easy for the public to understand that doesn't necessarily have a science or medical background. Now, I don't do all the research myself. I have a couple of resources composed of listeners. I've got one mailing list, for example, that has several hundred different people on it, mm-hmm. Many of them are doctors and PhDs in virtually every discipline. And when I have a particularly thorny question or something that I haven't been able to easily look up, I post it out on the list, and I get all kinds of fantastic information that I never would have been able to find on my own.
Okay.
Almost always from real doctors, too.
Right, right.
So I get a lot of great help that way.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, it's a weekly show, and putting together a weekly show is you don't have a great deal of time. And so I have to do the bulk of my research on the Internet, and that means that you have to have a really good understanding of how to use the Internet, how to separate the wheat from the chaff, the good information from the bad information. You have to learn how to read clinical trials. You have to learn how to read even just abstracts if you don't have time to read the entire article. You have to know what's a good study, what's a poor quality study. You have to be able to separate, and that's where the background in science comes in and becomes really valuable.
Certainly a background in thinking scientifically, I think, is helpful. And maybe before I go on with that thought, we ought to define. I think people have a knee-jerk idea that science is something extremely difficult. And often we use and think of the word science as meaning a body of knowledge, of facts about biology or your body. I think of the word science as meaning a way of thinking, a way of investigating and trying to document as best we can what's real and what's not real. It's not that unusual or that esoteric. It's just a way you start thinking about it. You agree, and would you like to talk about it?
Absolutely. That's a huge criticism of scientists is that people say, oh, they believe this, they have their dogma, this is what science has decided, and their minds are not open to any other information. And in fact, the exact opposite of true. The reason these people all have jobs is because they are constantly learning. They are constantly researching, constantly learning. And science, exactly as you say, it's really a verb. It's not a noun. It's the state of our knowledge is changing and improving every day. Theories are changing and improving every day. That's why we call them theories, because they're always open to change as new information is learned. You know, Newton gave us a good theory of gravity. Einstein improved it dramatically, and it's been improved more ever since. So even something as basic as gravity, mm-hmm. we're still improving that theory as we learn new information. Mm-hmm. That's the scientific process. And so when you talk about what is science, well, if you want to keep it a noun, then science is like today's best state of our understanding, and it'll be better tomorrow.
But, you know, and I argue that's one of the advantages of science is that it's constantly asking the question, do we understand it enough? And when you apply it to medical science, is do we know that this test is the best test or the most reliable, or is this treatment the best treatment? We're constantly testing against other things. It can be very disturbing to the public to say, gosh, well, this year vitamin D is in, next year vitamin D is out. But that's distinctly an advantage, if you think about it, versus what I'm going to use the term that Marcia Angell, one of the editors of the New England Journal, says, unproven therapies, which are so popular now, is that there is no ongoing testing or very little happening.
Yeah. Look what happened in the 1950s when the whole science of genetics was discovered. It revolutionized medicine. Mm-hmm. How did it revolutionize acupuncture? How did acupuncture grow and change when we learned probably the most fundamental thing we've ever learned about the way the human body works? That's one way that you can distinguish science from pseudoscience, is that science is always changing and improving, and pseudoscience basically stays the same century after century.
Good point. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. In Anchorage, call 550-8422. Our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us at line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and talk with Brian Dunning on Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, your health connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, providing early detection of breast cancer with digital screening mammography, and technologists with more than 170 years of combined experience. Information at provimaging.com. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. If you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today our guest is Brian Dunning. He's producer of the podcast Skeptoid.com, where we're talking about thinking critically about healthcare issues that are prominently in the news. You can email your questions and comments to Line 1, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org, or you can call us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. Please remember, you're listening to Line 1, and if you're listening to us tonight between 8 and 9, it's a recorded program at that time, and we won't be available to answer your calls or your emails. Let's get back to some medical issues. Aspartame, I don't hear so much about nowadays, but what is aspartame? What has been the concern from the general populace about taking or ingesting aspartame, and what's real and what doesn't seem to be real?
Yeah, aspartame is something that people had emailed me about quite a lot for a couple of years, saying, you know, oh, my friends told me that aspartame is a poison, that it will kill you. It causes multiple sclerosis. It gives you methanol toxicity. It was created by Donald Rumsfeld, and so it's evil by guilty by association. I mean, the whole long list of claims about aspartame. And so I went into research mode and spent several weeks digging up everything I could find and reading everything I could find and uncovering what all the sources of all of these rumors were. And basically what you find is that aspartame is an artificial sweetener. It's chemically not too different from most other sugars. It's 180 times as sweet. So as a result, you only need 180th of the amount to put in your diet soda to make it just as sweet. So that's why it's sold as zero calories, because it's, you know, only 180th of the calories of a regular soda. It's as simple as that. It's just a much more effective sweetener. It's artificially produced, though, and anytime something is artificially produced, people have all sorts of xenophobia about it. It's not all natural. Oh, it must be a dangerous toxin. You know, you look at the things like Donald Rumsfeld was associated with it. Well, turns out that's true. He was, before he was in government, he was a corporate turnaround expert, a financial wizard, a CEO for hire, sort of. And that's why he was hired for the company that was in the process of developing aspartame. And so it's while he was there doing his financial turnaround work that aspartame got approved. That's simply true. And so people say, oh, well, then it must have been some conspiracy with him and his government connections, you know, knowingly putting this poison on the public and profiting it as a result. But if you look at the science, if you look at the results, there's never been anybody injured from aspartame. There's no plausible reason to think it has any harmful effects. There's nothing wrong with any of the research that was done, the trials that were done to get it approved. There's one small group of people who shouldn't take aspartame, and that's, there's an illness called phenylketonuria where people can, is it phenylalanine
right.
that they can't absorb?
Yeah,
well, phenylalanine is found in a lot of foods, including breast milk.
Mm-hmm.
And those people shouldn't eat any of those foods. It's nothing specific about aspartame at all.
Yeah, and that's why it's on packages or foods and drinks and so forth, and to remind people that who might have that disorder where they can't metabolize phenylalanine correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, incidentally, that's another great way to discern a science-based product from a non-science-based product, is that science-based products will almost always give you all of the disclaimers. Here's what we found in the testing. Here's the negative effects that were reported. Here's the positive effects that were reported. They give you full disclosure, basically. And when you have a non-approved product, it basically doesn't give you any of that. It just makes some implausible, wildly miraculous claims and leaves it at that.
There are resources that are very good at helping people learn how to detect reality or what's real and what's not real. And I'd go back to maybe the first time I saw this ever written was with Carl Sagan's The Demon Haunted World, where he has a chapter on the fine art of baloney detection. And and then Steve Barrett has got a whole bunch of information like this on Quackwatch. It's a lot of it's been reproduced in various ways. But it's very good about how to look at Internet sites and how to think about what you're reading.
Yeah, that was I took a number of those lists. As you say, Carl Sagan had one, Stephen Barrett's had one, Michael Shermer's had one, and I combined them and boiled them down, and I made a 15-point checklist. These are 15 red flags that you might find if you're trying to determine whether a product is science or pseudoscience. And Oh, if you want, I can run down the list of 15 or give a couple of highlights.
Give us a couple of the really, really good ones, and then maybe if we can come up with an example of each of them. It's kind of like looking at logical fallacies, which I think are very interesting sometimes to think about.
That's fun. Well, one of them is similar. It's the appeal to antiquity. If you have a product that's said to be based on ancient knowledge, this is one that we see all the time, particularly if something is said to be based on ancient Chinese medicine, because the Chinese believed it 5,000 years ago, therefore it must be true. Well, why is that illogical? Because it assumes that we've learned nothing in 5,000 years. Everything we know that's useful or true about the human body, virtually everything, was learned within the last 100 years. Modern medicine is still very new, and prior to that, you know, we had all kinds of weird things that we thought the body was based on, you know, the four basic humors and all that nonsense. Well, so if you see a product that's being sold based on ancient knowledge, that's a pretty big red flag right there. Another one is, was this claim first announced through the mass media rather than through scientific channels? You remember this happened with the cold fusion experiment.
Yep.
These two doctors thought they had cold fusion working. Did they publish it? No. They called up the news and had reporters come down and put it on the mass media. That's not the way we do science. Science has to be tested and validated before it's ever made public.
Yeah, the other thing, similarly, you know, the company, the man and woman, the school teacher who developed Airborne, which we've talked about, who's, you know, got into a little bit of trouble about how they advertise that. I mean, if it's always bothered me, if somebody is that good and has discovered something that important and is so smart and are lucky that she's, you know, he or she have done something that millions and millions of dollars of research have not been able to accomplish, then they owe it to us to really document that what that is and make it more available to everybody. I guess you can say they're making it available, but they never did any testing. But, you know, they need to show us the research, prove to us that that's really what worked, not go and market it. So it's a little bit of a different way of thinking about what you just said. That just bothers me also.
Yeah, I mean, what they did, as you probably recall, is they basically hired two guys to write a paper and call it research, supporting the claims of their product.
Right.
Well, that was very thoroughly torn to shreds by anyone with any kind of scientific understanding.
Right.
And so they buried it. Basically, they took it off their website. Whenever people called in to ask about it, they said, oh, we don't think the public's smart enough to understand the nuances of an advanced clinical trial, so we don't make that available anymore.
Mm-hmm. Another issue, I had a gentleman on, gosh, a couple years ago now. Things happened so fast to me at age 61 now, I can't remember. But he was really hot and bothered about irradiated food. And I don't know if it's fair to ask you about this. I don't know how much you've looked into it. But he really had some popular book, good website, lots of information. And even the Europeans, many of the countries are quite worried about irradiated food. And yet my not thorough but rather reasonable looking into this sees no big issues. There's been several big reports suggesting that there seems to be no issue. Have you looked into this yourself or have any comments? Because I think it's an important issue.
Yes, I have. I did one episode all about food irradiation. The concept is you can package the food, you irradiate it with one of several different types of radiation, and that kills all the microbes that are in it and prevents it from becoming, you're having bacteria growing on it and so forth. Basically, it sterilizes it and makes it safe to put on a store shelf and sit there for a while and give it a shelf life. That's a good thing. That's what we all want to accomplish with our food production. But because the word radiation is a very scary word ever since you know that first A-bomb, it's been a very scary word for people. People are concerned about it. The way to think about it is you turn the light on in a room. What happens when you turn the light off? Is the room contaminated with light? No, the light's gone. The radiation is no longer there. That's what happens when food comes out of the radiation machine. It's not contaminated with anything. It was not sprinkled with radioactive waste. It had radiation passing through it, killing all the microbes on it. It's not contaminated in any way. But just like light can change the qualities of photographic paper, food can have some of its qualities altered by this radiation. So there's several different types of radiation that food producers use, and they have to do a lot of testing to make sure that they're using the right type for the right kind of food. Some radiation penetrates deeper. Some radiation is at different frequencies. Romaine lettuce is actually the best example of a food that you really can't irradiate, because no matter how gentle you are, it's going to change the texture and make it, you know, chewy and gooey, and it kind of makes it fall apart. Mm-hmm. So that's one product that you're not likely to see irradiated. Milk is a product that works very well. Meat is a product that works very well. You can safely irradiate those, and it'll improve their shelf life and virtually eliminate any chance that anyone's going to get sick from contamination from them.
I suspect that when all of the preservatives that have been used and so effective about it, enabling us to transport and move our food around the world so effectively were first coming out, there was a lot of resistance to those products as well, I would be my guess. I mean, that's a natural knee-jerk concern. And yet most of the time, all of this has gone through unbelievable amount of research that is not readily, easily available to the public. So they're not aware of the efforts that have gone into it. And as you said, even if you do spend gazillions of dollars and do everything exactly right, it doesn't mean that there won't be some problem develop. But at this time, all that seems to be working pretty well, and there's not any big red flags or worries about these things, as I understand them.
Yeah.
Let me also mention, well, let me give our phone number again. I'm trying to get some people to call in with their concerns or maybe some of their beliefs that may need to be addressed. If you're in Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8422. If you're outside of Anchorage, 1-800-478-8255. And our toll-free number, I'm sorry, not our toll-free number, but our email address is line1, that's LINEONE at APRN.org. I would like to know that people who like what they're hearing with Brian or have listened to his podcast, I've just found from listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and Steve Novella that you're up on the podcast award web spot to get voted as one of the most popular, I guess, top 10 podcasts. Is that?
That's right. Today is the last day to vote. Go to podcastawards.com. And you can vote for Skeptoid in the People's Choice category. Down in the Education category, we've got Skeptoid, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Astronomy Cast, several fantastic podcasts that are all dealing with critical thinking and all do a great job of helping people to think better and to understand the world about them better and more effectively to live better lives. So it's harder to make a choice in that category. Pick the one you like the best. But Skeptoid's all by itself up in People's Choice, so I urge everyone to throw a vote that direction.
How do the top 10 get chosen? Is that based on the number of hits or listening audience and so forth?
You know, I have to say, I honestly have no idea how they came up with the nominations. I don't know if people voted and suggested nominations that way or what. I really don't know.
Well, I certainly want to encourage listeners who are at all interested in how to think about some of these issues to listen to some of these podcasts. I find them extremely exciting. And along that same line, I got to also pat you on the back about Here Be Dragons. Maybe you want to talk about that. That was one of the first things I did and listened to when I first learned of Skeptoid.com.
Yeah, you know, one of the downsides of doing a podcast is that most people still say, huh, podcast? What's that? You know, I don't have an iPod. Well, so it's hard to disseminate information through a podcast. It's free and easy, so a lot of us do it. But people, it's not a great way to reach a lot of people. So I wanted to provide something that was in a video. It's on a DVD. You can watch it on a computer. You can freely copy it and give it away. And so I made basically a 40-minute introduction, a general introduction to critical thinking. We talk about medical topics. We talk about scientific topics. We talk about all kinds of things. We go through a lot of the logical fallacies. And it was designed for use in the classroom more than anything else. So it's called Here Be Dragons. It's available for free at herebedragonsmovie.com. If you want to get a DVD, you can order one off of Amazon, or you can download and burn your own DVD from it. But it's been really, really gratifying because every single day I hear from some teacher who's using it in his class. There are community colleges that make it required viewing for all students. Every time I hear that, it's like, ah, wait, no, I want to let me try again. Let me make it better. But people are using it. It's really gratifying, and it's I think it's something everyone should watch. But of course, I'm going to say that I'm biased. But Here Be Movies. Here Be Dragons Movie.com.
Yeah. Well, I'm not particularly biased towards making anything off of that, but I would strongly recommend it. You also have been involved in some TV stuff, as I understand it, and maybe even some video podcasts as I look around.
Yes, I have a video podcast that you're going to be seeing a lot more of. The beginning of the year, I made 3 pilot episodes. Those are also just free podcasts that anyone can watch on the Internet. That's called In Fact, and it's at infactmovie.com, although I shouldn't give that out because it's not there yet. You can find it at skeptoid.com. And the TV project you mentioned is very interesting. I kind of had the dream phone call that every podcaster hopes to get, and that was from a TV producer who says, hey, I want to make a TV show based on your podcast. So what was I going to say? I said, okay. And so last year we shot a pilot. The working title is The Skeptologists. As we have a team of scientific experts, MDs and PhDs all. Steve Novella was one of them, and Michael Shermer was another, in fact. And basically they receive the bat signal and jump into the Batmobile and race off to the scene of the pseudoscience to debunk with reckless abandon. And we did the whole show of taking this all through Hollywood and talking to all the networks, and we got a lot of extremely valuable feedback. And the most important piece of feedback, I'd say we got, the single most important piece of feedback, is that nobody cares that our show is promoting high-quality information. We went out with the message of, hey, even the people who believe in ghosts are sick of all the ghost hunter shows that are on TV. Right. Everyone wants a backlash. We're going to provide good information. Nobody cared. They want entertainment. They want sensationalism and good entertainment.
Yeah, and that's what they get. Yeah.
Yeah. So our job is now twice as hard. Mm-hmm. We have to provide sensationalism and good entertainment, but we have to also put it through the reality filter and help people by providing them good quality information, because we're actually ethical TV producers and we're trying to make a good show that's going to be good for people. Mm-hmm. So it's a much harder job. But it's one that we're working really hard at. We are in the process of reframing it. We're re-editing the sizzle reel that goes out to networks, and we're going to be taking it out again, including to PBS. So if there's any PBS affiliates listening out there, we're definitely looking for a letter of intent to go along with our grant proposal.
We have a couple of callers, Brian. Let's see if we can take those. Let's do Max. You're on line one. What can we do for you?
I just had a question. My mom smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day for 20 years,
yep.
And then was hypnotized, and then never smoked again.
Right.
My hunch is that there was a placebo effect happening there that gave her the confidence to sort of take on this addiction. Is there anything to hypnosis?
Yeah, hypnosis is a good one. And let me just, before we ask Brian, let me make a comment. My mom and dad both smoked about 3 packs a day for 40, 50 years until my dad had a cancer-related smoking-related cancer, and then my mom stopped it that same day. So you got to be aware that coincidence and causality again. But let's ask about hypnosis, particularly with smoking cessation. What do we know about that, Brian?
Well, I know a lot of doctors, a lot of psychologists, a lot of neurologists have answers one way or the other about hypnosis, but I would say the consensus is that the jury is still out, and I think it's a great example of why a lot of researchers have jobs in brain science and why it's such a fascinating area of research. Hypnotism is not something that I think you can say is a slam dunk, has either been proven or disproven to work. I think there's a lot of there's certainly things like stage hypnotism that are, you know, just a bunch of stage tricks. There's the type of hypnotism that you're discussing that does seem to have an effect in many cases. And can that effect also be explained by other factors? Well, yes, it certainly could. They wanted to quit smoking, so obviously they're likelier to quit smoking than someone else who's not wanting to quit smoking. But hypnotism is something I am not certainly prepared to say it's upheld or it's disproven. I think it's very, very interesting, and it's a great topic for research.
I don't think we really understand, from my understanding, what hypnosis is all about, and hopefully some of all the work now going into neurophysiology will help us maybe understand what that really entails. And as you said, the word hypnosis is used to mean several different things, too. We have to make sure we're comparing apples with apples with that word. Thanks for your call, Max.
Great. Thank you.
Yep. Rick, you're on line one.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for the call, or the taking of the call, and
sure.
Appreciate the subject. You mentioned irradiated foods, and I appreciate your comments there. I have an interest and concern that's really a global concern about GM, genetically modified foods.
Right.
I don't think we could even scratch the subject, but I would like to know if there's anything covered there.
All right, good question. And so how about genetically modified foods?
That's another fascinating question, and it's also a much broader one than you probably realize you're asking, because saying genetically modified food can mean a billion different things. Well, what trait are you talking about specifically? There's kind of trait can be genetically modified.
I'd be referring to the changing of seed stock. I saw a very interesting show called The World of Monsanto, which documentary, which was fascinating and talked about huge global ramifications of what, you know, kind of genetic modifications exist on our planet.
One thing I think you can be sure of is that there's a tremendous amount of anti-science propaganda out there trying to vilify GMO. People, organic food is huge, huge, huge business, as is GMO. And you've got to expect there's going to be propaganda on both sides. So this is where skepticism really comes into play. You can't stop at anything you've heard in the pop culture and the media because it's probably very biased.
Another comment that I've heard along this line, Rick, I think is important, is that the history of all our foods is naturally genetically being modified, or we began to develop and tease out and use crops that, you know, developed spontaneously that had certain characteristics that made them more usable. That's how we got corn. The history of corn is extremely understood from a genetic basis, and that's basically, I think, its history. And then there was a guy named Borlaug, who recently died, who probably is, I think he's a Nobel Prize winner, very few people know about, but he probably is credited with feeding more people on the planet Earth than anybody else by developing products that can grow much more substantially and better because of this genetic modification. So there's a lot of very, very positive things we should never forget about genetically modified food. So I'm sorry, Brian, but that was just – it's been on my mind for a long time to mention that guy and what he had to do.
Yeah, that's true. When they gave him the Nobel Prize, they actually said that he was directly responsible for saving a billion human lives. That's quite a huge number.
Yeah.
It's very important to keep in mind that virtually every single crop, virtually every product in the supermarket is not how it existed prehistorically, you know, 100,000 years ago. It's been crossbred and cross-pollinated and optimized by farmers for thousands of years. Now, we've just gotten better and better and better at doing that as we've learned better science and better ways to do it. And at some point, you get to a threshold where you can do virtually anything. And now we see things like the scientists can put in a time bomb in there, for example, where the seed can't be used after a certain year unless you add a certain chemical to it because you've paid your licensing fee. Now, of course, that's a whole other topic. That's not a science topic. That's a political discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly valid political arguments you can make on either side of that, or economic arguments, however you want to call it. I try to stick with the scientific arguments, and I think that the science of food production and being able to produce crops that are optimized to thrive in poor conditions, to reduce our need for chemical pesticides, chemical fertilizers, I think that's almost always a good thing. And the people who are doing the work, I think, would agree with me.
Well, I'd encourage you to check out The World According to Monsanto just for another view of the man-made genetic changes and what they might do to places where local changes in agriculture have occurred because of modifications that have eliminated natural growing crops. It was very interesting and eye-opener. Anyway, I appreciate your time, and I'm going to get off.
All right. Thanks for your call, Rick.
Thank you very much.
Is it Sergey? You're on line one?
Yeah, hi.
We have about 3 minutes, so we need to speed through this. What you got?
We'll do it quickly. I'm a practicing Anchorage surgeon, and I've been interested in these issues all my life. The whole alternative medicine thing is amazing, and the questions about why people want to believe all that stuff are mind-boggling. What I did want to turn to, though, was the fact that there's an awful lot of things in official in medicine that are equally dubious. And even given all the various rigorous tests that we subject our therapies and so on to, medicine seems to move along not entirely scientifically at all. And my question is, I was wondering if you might discuss the whole question of mammography, for example, the level of discussion that our politicians are pursuing regarding changing the standards for mammography is right. Absolutely ludicrous.
Right.
And the question is, how can we raise the awareness of the public, most of all,
right.
With regard to these issues? I mean, I think this is where skepticism is very, very important.
Yep. Wait, Brian, we have about a minute.
Yeah. How do we raise the public's awareness of critical thinking and skepticism? That's a question I've certainly been wrestling with for a long time. It's hard to do. You know, you also raise an interesting point that I find doctors are often the ones who have the most interesting and compelling healthy skepticisms of the pharmaceutical industry. And I always find it fascinating whenever I'm able to have a conversation with a doctor about that topic. I always learn a lot. How do we get, you mentioned the new mammography standards that came out, and immediately there was all sorts of uproar and furor. It was sexist, it was racist, it was just about any evil thing you could come up with. It was charged by people who really don't understand the issues. You know, you can start with better science education, but you know, that only goes so far. It's a question that I don't have a great answer for. How do we get people to think better about critical thinking?
Well, I want to really take the time to encourage our listeners to go to skeptoid.com and really keep an open mind and try to advance their understanding and thinking a little bit greater. So thanks very much for your time. It's been very stimulating for me, Brian. Appreciate it.
Always fun. Thank you.
Have a good day. Next week, we're going to return with Stephen Bezruczka of the University of Washington School of Medicine, and we'll be examining the evidence that a decline in our population's health relative to other rich countries is happening despite spending close to twice as much per person on health care as other countries do. There's also information that during a recession, our population health improves. Very interesting information. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.